Greetings and welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 304. It's the 20th of December, 2019. It's just right on 5 p.m. New Zealand time. Today is the Austral Summer Solstice, and it's just about right at this exact minute that we're crossing the point in time to where it's now going to be, by the time I finish this sentence, it's going to have gone from spring to summer. And in the northern hemisphere, it's gone from autumn to winter. So it's very interesting how all this timing and everything works with numbers and digits and everything like that. But unlike a lot of forms of time that we measure, astronomical time is based in what appears to be physical reality, the geometry of the planets as they revolve around the sun, the various tilts and angles of inclination and the eccentricity of the orbits. And, you know, so it's through a combination of all these things. This is what the solstice is, where, now, I believe in the southern hemisphere, the Earth is actually at its close to the sun. But I'm not sure, because perihelion is a body's closest approach to another body, and aphelion is its furthest distance. So I'm not sure if the solstices and the perihelions and aphelions occur at the same time. I don't think they do. But it's the angle of inclination, because the perihelion every year is different. So there's the minimum perihelion and the maximum aphelion, is the closest that the Earth ever gets to the sun, based on, I guess, what we've experienced or measured or, and more likely, extrapolated to believe to be the case, based on the constancy of existing patterns. You know, so it's quite complex, but anyway, what it boils down to is that here in the southern hemisphere, today is the longest day of the year, with probably the earliest sunrise and the latest sunset. And in the northern hemisphere, it's got the latest sunrise and the earliest sunset. So the longest amount of daylight in the southern hemisphere and the shortest amount of daylight and the longest night in the northern hemisphere. So from now on, it'll shift. Back and down here, the days will start getting gradually shorter. And in the northern hemisphere, the days will be getting slightly longer. And in the northern hemisphere, it's in the dead of winter, but with the weather situation being like it's been in recent years, who knows what it might be like. It could be 70 degrees in Boulder, Colorado. It's actually a beautiful day down here. I'm in reasonably sunny and warm Nelson, New Zealand, which is in the northern, sort of the eastern Golden Bay region of the northern part of the South Island, Te Waipunamu, Aotearoa, which is the Maori name for New Zealand. I've been back a week from yesterday. I flew back from Sydney. So this show is called Solstice Greetings from the South Island of New Zealand. Being here now during a sacred moment in time. And I was very much in awe of what was happening all over Australia. I'd been in Tasmania, in Apollo Bay, way in the far south regions of the mainland in Tasmania, for most of the past 3 months. So I wasn't even close to where all the fires were happening. But in my last 2 weeks there, I was up right in the middle of it and was about as close as you can get to actual fires without actually being endangered by it, because it was where I was staying in Katoomba. I could look out the window and actually see helicopters dropping water on a fire front that was down in the canyon, but less than probably a kilometer from where I was. So it was starting to encroach on some neighborhoods, and who knows what it's done in the past week, but it's absolutely horrific what's going on there. It's very nice to be back in New Zealand. Now, I've come from the land of where everything on the East Coast the southeast coast is burning. To here, we just had a pretty massive amount of rain the past 3 or 4 days. I'd say probably about 40 or 50 mils. And I've been trying to do my best to send this rain over to Australia, because we had a bit of luck with that when my friend Craig, the Yeti Buddhist, and I went camping at the very sacred Mount Yango back in whatever month that was, August or September. Mount Yango is sort of like the Uluru of the East Coast nations. It's about an hour and a half west of Gosford in the Central Coast. And it's in the extreme northern regions of the Blue Mountains World Heritage Area. But we went camping there, and it was very, very, very dry. And I did my ceremony with my sage and my flute and my drum and asked the ancestors if we might have a little rain. And sure enough, it started getting cloudy. It was already kind of a cloudy afternoon, but it got progressively clouder as we approached sunset. And it was just on the verge of getting dark, and we were setting up at this little campground. Craig was pitching his tent. We were getting ready to have some tea. And just almost within a minute of when Craig finished setting up his tent, a few little drops of rain started falling. So the rain started falling, and it fell and fell and fell very gently through the night and kept on going for several days. And this was the first rain that area and that whole surrounding area had in like 3 months. So I wasn't trying to take credit for it, but it was just a synchronistic occurrence that it happened. Well, I tried to do that again last week in the Central Coast, but I don't know if it brought any rain to that area. But I wasn't actually at Mount Yango. I was at Gosford, which is a good distance away. But there's so much climate change hysteria going on, and now there is sort of like a new, they're constantly updating the spin and mutating the vocabulary. So now it's rapid anthropogenic climate change. But, you know, I'm constantly pointing out the flaws, the logical and scientific errors and flaws and the contradictions and, in fact, oxymoronic nature of rapid climate change, because climate, by its very definition, is changes in weather patterns over a long period of time. So, in other words, rapid climate change would be like saying I haven't found the perfect metaphor or simile, but it would be like if you could see the hour hand moving on your clock like the second hand. That would be like rapid climate change. It would be that. It wouldn't be, in other words, any weather patterns that change rapidly is not climate. Climate is something that has to be where, by definition, climate is a pattern that has sustained itself for long enough to be recognized as a temporally stable pattern. And there's not a specific number of years or decades or centuries that a climate pattern must maintain itself, but it's not anything that changes in a few years or even less, a few months or weeks or days or hours, is not climate. That alone makes it all really, really bogus. But this whole thing with Greta the Great, and I think the expose, investigative journalism by one of my very favorite investigative researchers out there, his name's William Engdahl, E-N-G-D-A-H-L. Very, very, very fantastic work. But he's exposed the underlying, essentially, geopolitical and financial underpinnings of the whole climate change thing. It's really, well, it seems to me that what we're witnessing now through the the staged activities of these people that we see, because Ingdahl has documented how Greta is actually essentially employed by Al Gore's organization. Remember Mr. Inconvenient Truth and his top business partner. And these are people that have become billionaires on the back of the whole bogus climate carbon trading thing and stuff. His top business partner is a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, which is one of the biggest, most corrupt banking and financial monolithic institutions in the whole world. So what they're trying to do is this long-standing agenda of what you can truly call the New World Order, a coalition of all the top, most wealthy, influential people. They may not be on the same page with everything, but they're on the same page with enough different things that they're able to sort of muster all their resources and their manipulative operations capabilities into doing things that sort of benefits everyone's agenda, like the whole climate change thing. But it seems like one of the things they're doing with all this is they're trying to make every world leader look bad, or paying attention to how bad they are, or, you know, like, for example, Trump. Trump's the brunt of all ridicule. But it's so far beyond anything that can be real. I've always thought that the U.S. presidency, or as they lovingly call it, POTUS, P-O-T-U-S, President of the United States, that POTUS, ever since JFK, has been essentially a product, a psychological warfare operation orchestrated by the CIA or other factions of the intelligence community. And so that's why when Reagan became president in November of 1980, that Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, was the vice president, but he was really the president. Reagan was just the meat puppet standing out front. So really Bush was running everything. His vice president had just come from being head of the CIA. And just like he was involved with the assassination of JFK, sure enough, a week and a half after Reagan was elected, John Lennon was assassinated because he was probably the single biggest obstacle, because not only was he someone who was very, very well loved and respected and appreciated, not only as a musician, but as a spiritual and political leader. And he was coming out against these people. He had just said in a Playboy interview, just only a week or two before he was killed, that we must remember to thank the CIA for giving us LSD. So this was, I believe that this was December 8th, 1980, was the day that John Lennon was assassinated. I was in Berkeley, California, and I remember I could feel the collective vibe in that town. I knew something really heavy had happened. And so early December, today's the 20th, so we're past the middle of the month now, but I think around December 4th marked the 7th anniversary of the very first broadcast of On the Brink Radio. And December 7th was the anniversary of, I think, the 78th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, the attack where the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in Oahu, Hawaii, but known to be a very huge false flag event because the Americans had goaded the Japanese into attacking and they knew they were coming. They only left all the old battleships and stuff they wanted to get blown up there. But what it did was it gave America a legitimate reason to then enter and become involved in World War II, which is that's what it was all about. It was just like the new Pearl Harbor that had been called for all through the 90s by the Project for a New American Century. They were calling for a new Pearl Harbor to catalyze a revolution in military affairs that would put America solidly back on top of the heap of global hegemony and military imperialistic strength. unchallengeable by any opponent. So, therefore, on September 11th, 2001, we had the 9/11 false flag terrorism event. Also, in middle of December, we've got the, switching notes from the political to the astronomical, we've got one of the major meteor showers of the year, the Geminids, that comes from my very own constellation, Gemini. Castor and Pollux are spewing out some meteors for you. But apparently this meteor shower comes from when the Earth passes through the debris cloud of the breakup of an asteroid called 3200 Phaethon. That's P-H-A-E-T-H-O-N. Phaethon. Now, I believe, according to Emanuel Velikovsky, Phaethon was a Greek god of some kind of celestial being, some kind of monster or something like that. Anyway, it's very, 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 very interesting. So anyway, back to what I was saying about the leadership. It's like the powers that be behind the whole climate change orchestration operation, which is equal parts psychological warfare and equal parts geophysical warfare. They want to make every world leader look bad, as if probably a lot of them are put there by design just so that this can happen, or they're made out, they're coached into acting as if they're the biggest assholes in the world, just completely ineffective, incompetent, indiscreet, dishonest, corrupt, like Trump. That I saw, I mean, this is if you can believe all the stuff you see on social media like Facebook and stuff, but you know, just stuff I see, I take it all with a grain of salt, but you know, you've got apparently 800,000 people out in the street in France protesting against Macron. Okay, there you go. You've got all the hysteria about Trump in recent months, and now even the House has voted to impeach him. So that, you know, all it is a dog and pony show that gets people to go, oh, he's going to be impeached. It doesn't mean he'll be removed from office. Impeachment doesn't mean that. Nixon was impeached, and he actually resigned. But who knows? I mean, it's all a joke. So what Greta's calling out for? Oh, and Scott Morrison in Australia. Oh my God, the guy skips off to Hawaii, right in the middle of the most vicious bushfires that Australia's ever seen in modern times, and he's doing stuff like refusing to call in extra help, refusing to pay the volunteer workers. I think he did accurately admit that there is no credible scientific evidence that proves that Australia's carbon emissions have anything to do with these fires. And I must agree with him. I think that that's true. But he's guilty of what George Orwell, aka Eric Blair, his real name, said, that the biggest form of lying is omission. So he never made any mention, as far as I know, about the possibility of geophysical warfare technologies being involved in the environmental devastation happening in Australia or anywhere else. So here I am sitting here while all my friends in Eastern Australia are breathing massive amounts of smoke. I tend to think that, like, I keep in touch with my friends there because I love Australia, and I talked to my friend there a few days ago, and she said that the smoke wasn't nearly as bad as the media was saying. You saw the general tendency I've noticed is that whatever the media is portraying, no matter how bad they're saying it is, it's not quite that bad. I mean, sure, if something's burning up, somebody's house is burning up, or some koalas or something like that, that's horrific. Even if it's just one house, one person, one tree, one koala. And so all of that, it's absolutely horrific. And the point I was trying to make is that I think that the orchestration behind this whole thing is designed to manufacture consent in the public mind for the replacement of all these idiotic men leaders that are so ineffective and corrupt and stupid and evil, that are climate change deniers? How dare them? And the leader of every country, the guy in England, the Australian guy, ScoMo, Trump, Macron, and you've got this new, another trend that I've noticed in parallel to the denigration of the male leaders. You've got the rise of the young girl, the young woman leadership, and you've got Greta, and you've got that Cortez chick that was doing the Green New Deal. She also works for Al Gore's organization. And you've got other ones that are sort of like clones of Greta, all these young teenage climate change activists and stuff that are basically spewing pre-digested rhetoric that really is quite vacuous. I analyzed one of the talks, and it's like this was a talk by some scientists. You know, you could tell they were scientists. You know why? Because they had their white lab coats on, just to make sure you knew they were experts in their fields. They were demanding action. And in this short article, they used the word action like five or six times. Action. We must take action. We must demand action. And I go, but they don't say to do what or who's going to do it. And so this is what the public mind is being corralled into accepting the existence of, is some kind of organization. I don't know if it's going to be military or if it's going to be kind of like a green police. I've actually thought back on a film Alex Jones made about 10 years ago called Endgame. And it was actually, a lot of the stuff he was talking about actually seems to be coming true. He talked about the existence of a kind of a green police. So that's kind of what, we don't really see official green police with, you know, environmental protection uniforms on yet. But that could be what's coming. That could be what all this the call for direct action is going to lead to, is the creation of some kind of one world government environmental police state enforcement agency that's going to go around and make sure everybody's not emitting too much evil carbon dioxide, not driving, burning too many hydrocarbons, not consuming too much electricity, not eating too much food. Basically, part of the agenda is to decimate all of the Western economies, to bring them to their knees, and through the trying to pull the rug out from underneath the whole global hydrocarbon industry, even though a lot of these organizations like Goldman Sachs and the Rockefellers and stuff are actually made their giant fortunes from hydrocarbons. So now they're pulling out of it. But it's not about saving the earth. It's a financial reallocation of all these. Well, it's as abstract and sort of hallucinatory as possible, the whole thing with carbon trading and credits. And I didn't even realize that all still existed anymore. I thought it kind of got washed away with the rising sea level, which is another hoax. There's really not actually such a thing as sea level. But they're also, like my friend Claudia von Werloff, the Austrian academic professor who's a protege of Dr. Rosalie Bertel and very eloquent speaker about the truth of the whole climate change thing and geophysical warfare and the technotronic area of Zbigniew Brzezinski, which I see his blueprint being fulfilled day by day. He talks about the use of charismatic personalities. That's exactly what Al Gore was. That's exactly what Greta is. And they're carrying this message, kind of a nebulous mindfuck message to the public mind. But they want to, they're also, Greta's speechwriters are now poaching from the state-of-the-art literature that Dr. Claudia von Werloff writes. She's sort of addressing She uses the word patriarchy a lot to talk about how the world ruled and governed by men for thousands of years. But it's not really quite that simple, because you go like, ah, well, okay, what's the solution to that? Get rid of all the men. Just use them for their sperm, but don't let them do anything else. And then let women rule everything. And that's exactly what it looks like that they're trying to give the appearance of, with all the sort of the young, reasonably attractive women that are now the cabinet and leading executive body of Finland. You know, but who knows if that's really true, or, you know, what they're going to do, to me, the people we see in any government are not the actual decision makers. And why would these be any different? It's all about a dog and pony show that's what trying to create what people want to see as a form of entertainment. So if people are disgusted with Trump and Macron and ScoMo and want all these people out of there, but they want to see them, they're happy to see them replaced with these beautiful young women that are articulate, with all with blonde hair, and they're pretty with their little short dresses and stuff like that, and they're going to talk about saving the environment and climate change this and climate change that. People are going to go like, ah, well, you know, now we're on the right track, and they'll just believe anything these people say. And I betcha they're going to go like, well, look, you know, we've tried to get everybody to reduce emissions. We haven't tried to get people to stop breathing yet, but we've tried to reduce emissions from factories and automotive emissions and all this evil carbon dioxide, but it's just not working. You know, so what we're going to recommend is that these scientists, you know, those guys with the white lab coat, all these about 100 million scientists signed this official consensus document saying that they think that spraying a bunch of shit in the air, particulate aerosols, like with sulfur dioxide, like that comes out of volcanoes, this is going to reflect all the harsh, evil sunlight back into space and let the Earth cool, because it's so hot everywhere. And I think, and even though this chemtrails, as we call them, aerosol distribution of particulate matter, but really, chemtrails, the spraying of all this stuff from planes, it's like a hypodermic syringe. It could inject anything that can be aerosolized, can be sprayed from a plane. So who knows what it all is. But it's not water vapor, as many people cling to believing. So even though this has been going on for more than 20 years, and the atmosphere is already saturated with all this stuff, they want to... Now, if they make it above board, and everybody's going, well, but we need this. It's okay. So then they'll just do it. It'll go to the next level of how much. They won't even have to pretend like it doesn't exist. Though people will actually, they'll be cheering it. They'll be going like, oh, look, come and spray some over our city. So we'll be able to, so we can be cool. Ah, there you go. That's it. They want people to feel like they're really cool. But this is the absolute worst thing that we could be doing. We're back to the threshold of the Atlantean discontinuity, as I've talked about numerous times, as Sherlock Holmes talked about. I still can't believe that I was able to communicate with him, albeit with Morse code, was able to actually converse with Sherlock Holmes, and he said that he would come back on the show again. So maybe after the first of the year, we'll have the very paragon of sleuthing himself to give us an updated report on all this climate change stuff. And maybe he was going to try, I think Sherlock's actually on Mars right now, because he was going to go there, even though he's got ways of traveling using a modified version of Doctor Who's TARDIS. He can go to Mars a lot faster than us in a normal spacecraft could go. It's still not instantaneous. It's still sublight velocity with the TARDIS 2.0. But I think he's there right now because he was going to try to make sure that the Martians know as much as they can about Elon Musk and his plan to come there and do some terraforming with hydrogen bombs and try to start converting the atmosphere. I don't know if he's going to put oxygen into it or maybe some whatever kind of gases that silicon-based life forms like. Maybe aerosolized silicon? I don't know, silica gel to help it be a little drier. Who knows? The sky's the limit with all this stuff, literally. But In next week's show, I'll talk a bit about some of the highlights of 2019. To me, this is the year that I almost never got used to writing 2019 whenever I had to write the date. I always go like, oh, this is the new year, 2018's over. And now that I've just almost got used to writing it, it's almost over in just a couple, less than 2 weeks. It's going to be 2020, which is going to be quite freaky. I keep jumping from subject to subject here. I'm sitting in my beautiful little studio sleepout space, courtesy of my beautiful new friend, Rudolf Samper from Germany here in Nelson. He's letting me both stay with him and then house it while he's gone away for Christmas. And I've got a beautiful place to paint and catch up here in Nelson. And it's also, I'd like to thank my friend Julia from Russia, the geologist massage therapist who's so wonderful, who made this connection. And it's really, really special to be here. But I'm sitting in my little room because even though where we are, it's very beautiful, and there's a beautiful river, a tributary of the river right out back that you can hear. There's a good bit of traffic now because it's about 5:30 on Friday afternoon of the weekend before Christmas. So there's a bit of traffic, but you can hear some birds chirping, and I've got the beautiful sunshine almost shining in on me now. Put the umbrella on my painting table, and Rudolf took me to a really nice beach where I gathered up probably about 400 really nice rocks that can be painted on, really nice and flat. Many of them are a variety common here in New Zealand called grey wackies. But it's very nice to be here. So now it's officially summer, especially if they start doing the stratospheric aerosol dispersion at a higher level. We're really going to be encroaching on extraordinarily thin ice in terms of all the different ways that we're waging war against life and against Mother Earth. And I just feel more than ever. There's actually an article I read from NASA about how they've just discovered a new kind of magnetic field coronal ejection on the sun that's never been seen before. So this is in line with many other sort of new or modern versions of natural phenomena that I've noted in some of my broadcasts before. For example, during the exact same time frame that HARP and all the geophysical warfare activities have come fully online, about the past 20 years, we've seen new modern earthquakes that have come around with a unique anomalous electromagnetic signature. France even put up a special satellite called Demeter to study them. We've got new kinds of bushfires that have where trees start burning from the inside and whole houses will be leveled, but the shrubberies right next to it are fine. We've got new kinds of auroras. We've got new electrojets. We've got new lightning and new thunderstorms, dry lightning strikes that strike just out of nowhere, and they strike on the land in straight lines, in parallel straight lines, and all of these have the characteristic signatures of artificially created geophysical warfare operations. So now with this new kind of magnetic loop or something like that that they've seen on the sun, it really makes me think of the solar tap that was talked about by Walter Richmond in his book, The New Millennium, about his novel about the Atlantean scientist priests that were tapping into the sun with electromagnetic or crystal-based energy somehow, and they were trying to bring down the energy of the sun, and it too much of it came, and it actually burned up a big part of the earth and split the continent and made Atlantis sink and sent the earth spinning haywire off its axis. Quite a Velikovskian catastrophic evolution scenario. But I really feel like something like that is in the works, and I've came across a video thanks to a guy in the Electric Universe Geology group on Facebook. He was a Spanish astronomer. I think he was from Mexico or South America somewhere, but down in Central or South America. His name was Munoz Ferrada. That's M-U-N-O-Z F-E-R-R-A-D-A, Munoz Ferrada. And he was an astronomer who apparently was studying the motions of all these different comets and asteroids and celestial bodies. And he, because of his understanding of the way that the presence of these bodies influences volcanic and tectonic forces here on Earth, he successfully predicted not one, not two, but a whole string of major earthquakes in South America back in the, when was this, in the 1950s or 60s, I think, or not even, maybe even earlier. Successfully predicted a whole lot of earthquakes based on all this astronomical stuff. And apparently he also surmised the existence of not only another planet, but possibly two other planets, one of which has an orbit similar to the existing planets, but it's just further out, basically more or less circular around the sun. But another planet that he called Nemesis, other people have called it Marduk, Nibiru, Planet X. Zechariah Sitchin called it the 12th planet. I'm not sure what the 11th one was, or even 10. But this one apparently has a very elliptical orbit that brings it from way far out and then in very close to the sun. But I'm not sure over what. This would be an orbit identical to that of a comet or an asteroid. So I'm not sure exactly what makes this body different from a comet or asteroid. Maybe the difference is in size. So I'm just now starting to try to delve into his work. I saw a really cool YouTube video that showed some very interesting diagrams and stuff, but the second part of his hypothesis is that not only is there a 10th planet and then this 11th planet with the elliptical orbit that comes in close now and then, there's also a small brown dwarf star that's quite massive but invisible at optical wavelengths, that's not that far from the sun, and that the sun and this star are kind of like a binary star system that sort of, they rotate around each other or revolve around each other around a common sort of center of gravity, and that this planet Nemesis, its orbit and the way it behaves with the sun and the planets in our solar system has a lot to do with this other star too. So this is some very, very, very complex celestial mechanics. And apparently he was dealing only with gravitational, Newtonian, Cartesian mechanical forces. So when you add in the post-Velikovskian electric universe thunderbolts aspect to all this, it makes it even more interesting, because the guy that posted this story on Facebook was talking about how this planet Nemesis may have a residual electrical charge that it builds up, and that when it gets close enough to planets as it's passing through the solar system, it might discharge. And so this brings up a whole very, very, very interesting array of concepts and ideas to think about, because you'd go like, well, you might be able to map out, this guy Ferrada might have mapped out what he thought was the orbital characteristics of this thing and when it might be due back and where all the other planets were going to be as it comes in and what the geometrical and gravitational relationships are going to be. But then also, if you start adding in the electrical, if you look at the, for example, what the heliocosmic conditions are during that time, whether we're at a minimum or a maximum in the sunspot cycle, and that's going to affect the solar wind and the cosmic ray flux. And all this stuff has to do with the ionization potential and the ability of the whole interplanetary space inside the orbits of the planets, how it's going to conduct all these plasmas and electromagnetic energies that might be emanating and conducted and transmitted by this planetary body passing through. This would happen with every comet and asteroid, but if this thing is really big, it might have a huge charge on it. And so, you know, to try to start looking into the what the electrical conductivity of the planets are, because you'd think, like, we know that Jupiter is almost like a small star. It emits a lot of radio waves that Emanuel Velikovsky actually predicted before they were discovered. But Earth has a lot of water. We've got highly metallic nickel iron core, molten, we think, and the Mother Ocean covering over 70% of our surface, which is a very interesting conductor of electromagnetic energy. And so this is, I'm just right in the middle of running into all this stuff now, but I really feel like that our, you know, even without the presence of humans, the Earth and all the other planets would still be subject to these interplanetary discharges, many of which are a lot of these electric universe scientists think that that's what a lot of craters on the Moon and Mars were formed by, electrical action, not water erosion. So it's probably both and more. But to understand what might happen, how we've affected the electrical conductivity of the Earth through all of our radio and microwave transmissions, this is just as a side effect of industrial civilization, and then all the nuclear stuff that we've done, and then now in recent decades the geophysical warfare with using intentionally aimed ionospheric heaters to manipulate the ionosphere, and even probably trying to mess with the sun and stuff like that. So we've thrown a wrench into the whole balance that might have existed before, and who knows how that's going to affect what might happen when a highly charged and gravitationally powerful body like a rogue planet, not to mention a large chunk of a comet like a daughter fragment from Comet Encke that comes around every 3.2 years. And so you could have multiple encounters of different cometary fragments and asteroids and rogue planets and stuff. I mean, this is the dynamics of the complexity and the busyness of the neighborhood up there in space, not to mention all the human space junk that we've put up there. So anyway, this is very, very, very interesting food for thought, but we're coming up on the biggest holiday of the year called Christmas. Everybody knows what that is. It's when Santa Claus comes down your chimney. But I learned of another mus that I've talked about before that's back in, I think it's in September, October. It's Michaelmas. It's a holiday celebrated in Catholic countries like South Africa when the Archangel Michael battled the dragon. And that's when this meteor shower happens, when my favorite flower, the Senecio elegans cineraria or Namaqualand daisy, blooms. And so Michaelmas celebrates that. And so I don't know how many musses there are. There's Christmas, Michaelmas, Australiamus. We must all send our most beautiful blessings for all the koalas and all the swift parrots and orange-bellied parrots and all the all the people in the trees and the plants and the marsupials and the reptiles and the amphibians, everybody getting burned up and damaged and refugeed by these fires. Pray for rain. That's the biggest thing to do. Pray for sending some rain to Australia. Demanding action. That's so funny because it's implicit with all the climate change hysteria. They never say what it is that whoever's going to do it, they don't even say what it is they're supposed to do. Demand action. You know, so I think equally important as understanding what action is supposed to mean is the word acticians. That's what these people are that we're seeing. they're acticians, a cross between actors and politicians, or, you know, like, I'm not sure what Greta would be. I think she genuinely believes what she's doing. That's why so many people are taken with her, because she is, I listened to her talk once, and I think she is sincere. And so that makes it all the more diabolical that she, just like Trump's going to be expendable one of these days, unless they put her in office there in Finland, or maybe in, maybe she's going to be the new prime minister of Sweden. They're going to lower the age. She'll be the prime minister of Sweden. And then she can go and set up shop on Mars with Elon Musk. And Al Gore can be there too. Anyway, enough levity. I better sign off and get this show edited and uploaded. And many, many, many thanks to Jewel Stanley at UCY-TV. Hope to be interviewing her soon. I hope to be doing another interview with Dr. Fritjof Capra and Dr. Nick Begich, Claudia von Roelof, a guy named Gordon Hempton, who's a specialist in listening to silence. And I'm hoping to do an interview with my friend Kaitiaki Moana, Glenn Edney, and possibly another marine biologist here in New Zealand named Steve Hathaway. Both of these guys knew the recently deceased Jacques Cousteau of New Zealand named Wade Doak. They knew him quite well, and I met Wade back in the year 2000. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off from Te Wai Punamu e Te Aroa. Kia ora, kia manuia. Live long and prosper. Keep it in the road. And remember, a little dabble do ya. Good day. The music we're hearing in the background is a brand new track I recorded with Ian McAllister in Christchurch last week. It's the first time I've ever played electric guitar along with my flute. And it's got a really cool kind of a metallic sound that resulted from me using the bow for Ian's double bass across the strings of the electric guitar tuned in my special modified F-sharp tuning. So this is just the beginning of a work in progress. It's called Continuum.